In 1913, Nicholas II, Tsar and Supreme Autocrat of all the Russias, commissioned the latest in a series of decorative eggs from the Romanov family jeweller, Peter Carl Fabergé. In gold, silver and diamonds, it told the stories of three centuries of Romanov rule over one of the largest empires in human history. Barely 5 years later, Russia was a revolutionary dictatorship, and its empire shattered into warring fragments. Joining me to discuss the story of Russia and its revolutions are Ben Loosley, Lucy Robb and Tristan McLeod from the Wellington College History Department. Ben, could you give us an idea of the scale and diversity of the empire that Nicholas II had inherited in 1894?
The Russian Empire was called the Russian Empire, but only 55% of the population was Russian. It was called on Earth's surface. It's an enormous empire. It's ruled by the Russians, but there are a whole host of different nationalities, from Finns, Poles, Ukrainians, Armenians, and a whole host of different religions amongst that. You have the Orthodox religion, the Russians, the Muslims and Jews. So incredibly diverse, though I suppose in one crucial way, not particularly diverse. 82 or so percent of the population are peasants, living in villages and largely isolated.
So ruling this empire would surely have needed a czar of real skill and determination, given its scale, and a system fit for purpose. Did Russia have either of these in the early 20th century?
Well, unfortunately not. Nicholas II, the czar, he's conscientious, he's hardworking, but he is inflexible. He has no interest in political reform and has committed himself to maintaining his power as an autocrat, by which that means he has full control, and the ministers, indeed the population essentially, must do what they're told when they're told to do it. The system is, given how diverse the empire is and how big it is also not very fit for purpose. He has a council of ministers. They are appointed by him. They have no sense of collective responsibility, and the decisions, therefore, are not necessarily joined up. In addition, ever since the 1905 revolution, the country has had a Duma. Now, the Duma was an assembly, partially elected, a franchise that gave more electoral kind of power or weight to the middle classes. But this Duma was had no role in government. It was merely there to advise, to criticise, perhaps. And the Tsar was not interested in giving it any more power than he had to, and would largely aim to sideline it.
Ben, you just told us a little bit about the Duma and mentioned the Tsar's attitude towards it. Lucy, am I right in thinking that there were elections of a sort in Russia at this time? But were they elections as we would understand them today? I mean, was this a properly constitutional monarchy?
No, essentially it wasn't. So there were elections after 1905 and the Duma is created. There are elections, and the first two Dumas that are created are sort of more representative, but Nicholas sort of refuses to work with these. He doesn't like the political radicals who are elected. There's sort of changes made between the second Duma and the third Duma. The Prime Minister Stolypin essentially changes how the voting takes place so that normal workers can no longer vote, which essentially changes it. So the third Duma is more sort of is not as radical, and because of that, Nicholas is able to work with it more easily. So there was some sort of voting, but it was incredibly sort of marginalised, and so not everybody had a say in what went on.
It sounds a bit rigged, Lucy.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, it certainly was rigged so that Nicholas could essentially work with people who he was more inclined to work with rather than what Russia actually wanted and who they wanted to represent them.
In August 1914, the First World War turns to conflict, and Russia invades Germany's Prussia in fulfilment of an alliance with Serbia and France against Germany and Austria. Tristan, could you tell us a little bit about how Russia was prepared for this war and the outcome of this offensive onto German territory?
The initial offensive was actually fairly successful, and actually the speed of which the Russians responded surprised the Germans. Initially they did make good tracks, especially against the Austrians. Unfortunately, their preparations were not quite as good as the speed by which they responded to war starting. In August of 1914, the Battle of Tannenberg, the Russian army met with their first major defeat, which left 170,000 dead or wounded. And then they lost again in September at the Masurian Lakes. And the Russian advance into East Prussia turned into a retreat from East Prussia.
And further defeats follow, don't they? So the Russians lose Warsaw in 1915, and in that year their ally Serbia also seems to be on the ropes. Tristan, how did the Tsar react to this disastrous first year of war?
The Tsar took it upon himself to take control of the army himself on the 22nd of August of 1915. And it left him as a bit of a hostage to fortune, because any subsequent defeat would mean that he would be personally responsible.
And how well qualified was the Tsar to lead a modern army?
not very well prepared at all. He had very little experience at all personally.
Ben, do you want to come in on this?
Yeah, well, I think it's also important to note that while Tristan's absolutely right, the Tsar has very little proper military experience. It's often easy to say that the war goes badly because of him. But obviously the war was going badly in the first place. It's why he takes over. The war continues to go badly. So I think the impact, I suppose, of the Tsar taking command in 1915 is not that the war goes less well. It's more, as Tristan says, how now any defeat can be attached to him directly. There's no one he can fire, particularly to shift the responsibility. That's the crucial error, I suppose, that he's made.
And that sounds like a bit of a problem, Ben, with the whole autocratic system, that it's very difficult for the Tsar to offload responsibility.
Yes, though they've been very good at that over the years. The problem in during the war, I suppose, is that the problems they're facing are so much greater than they faced before. The war, first example of a total war, industrialised warfare, and Russia is not industrialised, nowhere near capable of kind of competing, I suppose, with Germany, what have you. So, yes, the problems are bigger, but taking command of the army means that there's no one to fire. Indeed, Nicholas is becoming something of a lightning rod, I suppose, for discontent.
Ben, you've just mentioned the relative weakness of Russia's industrialisation relative to the other great powers. War seems to be the ultimate stress test of any society. Lucy, could you tell us a little bit about some of the stresses on the home front in Russia?
Yeah, so Russia really struggled during the First World War. We've heard a little bit about their huge losses on the battlefront. By 1916, of the 12 million men who'd been conscripted, a quarter of them were no longer fighting. So part of that obviously was because of these huge losses in battles like Tannenberg and things like the Brusilov offensive. But it was also due to things such as suicide and also desertion. So the morale on the Russian army, was incredibly low, and they had the highest suicide rate of all the combatants. Nations. So these feelings on the home front, these feelings on the war front, definitely translated back to the home front through letters and also through press. So the huge losses had a huge effect on morale. Partly, obviously, it was, mourning the massive loss of life. But as we've heard about Nicholas's decision to take control of the army in 1915, he was considered personally responsible. So these ill feelings, this hatred towards the war, was definitely targeted towards Nicholas. Now, most of the population, they didn't feel that Russia didn't have the ability to win the war. They just felt that Nicholas was not the man who would be able to take them to this victory. Aside from obviously that mourning the loss of life, there was economic issues which ravaged the home front. So by December 1916, food prices had increased by over 700%. So workers could barely afford to feed themselves. The winter of 1916-17 was also particularly bad, with fuel shortages being added to the food shortages. This in turn led to things like health problems, and eventually, obviously, Petrograd descends into chaos, and we have the striking. And all of that sort of thing. And also we must remember that because Tsar Nicholas was at the front line, it was obviously Tsarina and her trusty advisor Rasputin who were left to manage these problems.
You've just mentioned Rasputin, and so much has been said, written, and indeed sung about Rasputin. Who was he, and how did he become important to the fate of the Romanov family and their empire?
So Rasputin was a monk, and he worked his way into Russian high society through his sort of religious mysticism. He was a bit of a wild character, led a pretty scandalous life, and he became involved with the Romanov family because they believed him to have powers capable of healing their son. So the Tsar only had one son, an heir, Alexei, who had hemophilia, so his blood couldn't clot. So the Tsar and his wife believed that Rasputin had the power to heal their son through prayer. So this is why, despite the fact that he was, you know, had a very scandalous reputation, he was allowed so much influence.
Ben, a moment ago Lucy was telling us about the home front and some of the problems in the economy, and I'm guessing that would have included strikes. Could you tell us about the Soviets? Who were the Soviets and what did they do?
Well, the word Soviet is merely Russian for council, and they were organised spontaneously, more or less, by workers in factories to provide a forum to defend their interests against the factory owners, who they felt sometimes were exploiting them. So the Soviets, the first ever Soviet was organized in 1905 in St. Petersburg during the 1905 revolution, and it's reborn in 1917 during the kind of chaos towards the end of February as the Petrograd Soviet. So they offer a forum for the workers to articulate their needs, their interests, and to defend them against class enemies, the government, or whoever they think poses a threat to them.
So we have these radicalised workers' committees. I mean, this suggests a society that's in quite a lot of political torment. Is there anyone warning the Tsar about the severity of the situation, and is he a listener?
Well, yes, we have to remember that the Tsar is not in Petrograd during this during kind of February time, 1917. And there are some warning voices, and they're largely coming from the Duma. Now, we said the Duma was, its role was to advise, offer political support, but also to criticise. And by February 1917, it's largely being critical. Despite the fact that, as Lisa mentioned earlier, the Duma was elected largely only by middle-class Russians and was fixed, as it were, so that it was more liberal, I suppose, more middle-class, more conservative and more loyal to the Tsar. By February 1917, the loyalty of these Duma politicians has been stretched pretty much to breaking point. One key warning that does reach the Tsar was from the president of the Duma, Michael Rodzianko. He telegrammed the Tsar once the strikes and riots had broken out in February, urging him to respond, urging him to replace his ministers who had lost the confidence of the people, he said, and set up a government that could run the war better. I suppose to indicate the Tsar's contempt for Rodzianko and his failure to grasp the seriousness of the situation, he wrote in a letter to his wife, Alexandra, that fatty Rodzianko has telegrammed me some nonsense, I'm not even going to reply. The Tsar was forced to abdicate days later.
And in terms of how that's brought about, a lot of the political pressure actually seems to be coming from the streets. Tristan, could you talk us through the events in Petrograd across the end of February and the beginning of March?
Rodzianko, when he sent that warning to the Tsar, had good reason. In the days running up to that, the message being sent, there was a full-scale strike at the Putilov steelworks, which was the largest and most politically active factory in Petrograd. This was followed 5 days later with the International Women's Day, which brought thousands of women onto the streets. 2 days later, 25th of February, a general strike begins across the city, and they estimate that about 250,000 people were on the streets of Petrograd on that day. These people were not led by anyone in particular, but it was just a sign of general discontent that caused Rodzianko to plead the Tsar to do something drastic.
And Tristan, surely the Tsar simply could have called on the army to clear these people away in the way that he'd done back in 1905 in Bloody Sunday.
He certainly did ask the Petrograd garrison to help out, but they then promptly mutinied. The only other option left to him in terms of using the army would be to bring forces back from the Eastern Front, which he never did.
It must have been an extraordinarily dramatic moment when Nicholas ceases to be Tsar. If we think of the depositions of kings in the past, was the moment of Nicholas's abdication a dramatic one?
No, in no way. It was rather a sad end, actually, to the Romanov dynasty. He was making his way back, or trying to make his way back to Petrograd, on the imperial train, but railway workers, rebellious railway workers, stopped the train 200 miles south of Petrograd, and it was stuck in the sidings next to the main line. Until he finally agreed to abdicate on the 2nd of March.
So after 304 years of rule by one family, the Tsarist monarchy seems to end more with a whimper than with a bang. Lucy, can you tell us a little bit about how the vacuum is filled following Nicholas's abdication?
So basically, the vacuum is filled by the provisional government. So it was essentially members of the Fourth Duma that Nicholas had suspended during the war. They get together and they form the provisional government shortly after Nicholas's abdication. And their plan was to rule Russia until elections could be held for a constituent assembly.
And who do you think they actually represented? When they take over? I mean, are they a broadly based government?
Well, the new government is mostly represented by the middle and upper classes of Russian society. So they mostly had connections with Russian aristocracy, business leaders, universities, and that sort of thing. So this meant that essentially they had little in common and thus, and consequently little influence over soldiers, peasants and urban workers, who, of course, made up the vast majority of Russian society.
Ben, you were telling us earlier about the Soviets. Can you tell us about the importance of Order Number One and what it meant?
Yeah, so I mentioned earlier that during the chaos of the revolution, the Petrograd Soviet was established. And in contrast, I suppose, to what Lucy has said about the provisional government, the Petrograd Soviet does represent the workers of Petrograd and the soldiers of the garrison. Essentially, every factory would elect one or two of their number, and they would be sent to the main assembly in the Tauride Palace. Similarly, every kind of garrison and every barracks would send one or two of their number. So you've got an assembly here that actually can claim some measure of legitimacy and certainly has the loyalty of the vast majority of the population in Petrograd. And they are in this curious kind of power-sharing, unofficial arrangement with the provisional government. And the balance of power between these two, the system often known as dual power, can be illustrated with reference to Order Number One. Order Number One was issued by the Petrograd Soviet, again, really before actually the Tsar abdicates, so during the chaos of the revolution. And in it, it stated that all soldiers should follow the instructions of the provisional government, insofar as they weren't then contradicted or were not contrary to the orders of the Petrograd Soviet. So in that sense, what the Soviet has done is that it is assuming ultimate control over the soldiers, whilst allowing the provisional government to have the appearance of authority over them. Now, the soldiers should do as they're told unless we tell you otherwise, is the message from the Soviet. It's really important because what we have here is a provisional government which does struggle for legitimacy, but nevertheless, everyone is content for it to be in control since it has the greatest amount of experience and is best placed, I suppose, to assume the role of government. But the Petrograd Soviet doesn't trust it, and so it wants to make sure that the provisional government cannot use soldiers in ways that which are contrary to the revolution or what have you. And so it's making sure that ultimately, when push comes to shove, if the soldiers receive an instruction from the provisional government and a contrary one from the Soviet, they will do as the Soviet tells them to do. For a provisional government trying to assert itself, this hamstrings it really through the rest of the year.
Now, the Soviets were a political movement of the left, and one politician whom we haven't talked about yet, who becomes very important to our story, is Lenin and the Bolshevik Party. Had Lenin had any role to date, really, in the politics of Russia, and how does he come into our story?
So Lenin, he is the leader of the Bolsheviks. Now, they are a faction of the Social Democrat Party. The Mensheviks are another faction of the party. Lenin is a communist. He wishes to bring a communist revolution to Russia. But he hasn't been in Russia for, more than a decade. He was last in Russia in 1905 when he returned to the country having fled from exile. But after the failure of the 1905 revolution, he had returned to Europe because he wasn't safe in Russia. The secret police, the Okhrana, would arrest him. His brother had been executed back in the 1880s. So
Ben, could you tell us who the main influence was on Lenin's political philosophy?
Yeah, so Lenin is a Marxist, so that means he his main influence is Karl Marx. Now, Karl Marx had argued that capitalism was a system that would, in time, be replaced by, well, socialism and then ultimately a communist society. What he means by that is that capitalism was a society or an economic system run by a minority of the population, essentially, the factory owners, people that Marx described as the bourgeoisie. Marx described the system as fundamentally exploitative because we have a small number of factory owners creaming off the profits created by a large number of workers who are living in terrible conditions and working in terrible conditions and earning a pittance. He said the system was fundamentally unfair and that what it would lead to was a revolution whereby the large number of workers would seize control of the government and use it to create a society that was more equal. And that act in the interests of ordinary people because these workers were more like what they were, the ordinary people. So if they were in charge, then the government would therefore be acting in their interests. Lenin is inspired by this vision, even though he himself, of course, is middle class and so many of the revolutionaries were middle class. He is a Marxist intellectual who is persuaded by Marxist criticism of capitalism. So Lenin is keen, as soon as possible, to instigate and lead a overthrow of power in Russia. That the Tsar has gone, he welcomes, but he sees very little difference between the provisional government and the Tsar. They're essentially replacing one ruling class with another ruling class.
Ben, you've outlined this this radical Marxist thinker, and yet, as you mentioned earlier, he is out of Russia, and this all seems rather abstract. Could you tell us a little bit about how Lenin goes from being a thinker on the sidelines to a man of action at the centre of events?
Lenin, during the revolution, when it starts, he's in Switzerland, and he's there because Switzerland is neutral, and therefore he's safe essentially from the war. He won't be arrested by, say, Britain or France, who see him as a dangerous revolutionary, and obviously the Germans will see him as Russian, therefore one of the enemy. So that's a safe place for him. But when the revolution starts, he wants to get back as soon as he can. But he's stuck in Switzerland and surrounded by countries at war. However, the Germans recognise the value of somehow engineering Lenin's return to Russia.
Hold on a second. We've got a conservative nationalist military monarchy in Germany. What on earth have they got to do with a radical Marxist revolutionary?
Well, yes, indeed. And in some ways, thinking about how later communism will try to assert itself in Germany, they do set themselves up for fall later on. But at the time, during the war, very much the principle, my enemy's enemy is my friend. Now, if Lenin is committed to overthrowing the provisional government, then Lenin will be a useful troublemaker for the Germans to somehow inject into the political situation in Petrograd. And so that's exactly what they do. They negotiate with Lenin and they set up a sealed train that will take him from Switzerland across Germany. He then gets shipped across the Baltic to Finland, which at that time was part of the Russian Empire. It's a sealed train because what they don't want is Lenin to be spreading any of his dangerous ideas in Germany. But they essentially want to inject him into Russia and hope that he will cause trouble.
He sounds like the original WMD, doesn't he? That he has to be sealed in.
Yeah, absolutely. And he definitely does eventually, I suppose, complete the job that the Germans hoped he would. He does ultimately pull Russia out of the war. He will engineer the collapse of the Prussian government. So I guess in that sense, at least in the short term for the Germans, their plan works.
Tristan, could you just tell us the plan that Lenin outlines on his return? He has some very snappy kind of political principles that he's able to articulate almost on the point of his arrival.
Absolutely. So these become known as the April Theses. And fundamentally, they can be boiled down to three key points: that the power should be transferred to the Soviets, that the war should be brought to an immediate end, and that all land should be reallocated to peasants by local Soviets. And that is summarised as peace, bread and land.
And does this have an impact on Bolshevik support on his return?
It doesn't automatically work. Even the Bolsheviks are undecided about whether to support the provisional government. The Mensheviks thought that it would undermine the Petrograd Soviet and perhaps even provoke a sort of reactionary right-wing response from supporters of the Tsar. And in fact, even in June, the All-Russian Congress of Soviets met and actually had a vote of confidence in the provisional government, even at that point.
Does Bolshevik Party membership go up, though?
I just want to chip in to talk about the confusing thing with the Soviet, because as Tristan just mentioned there, you've got all Russian Congress of Soviets voting to continue with a dual power sharing arrangement with the provisional government. Now, why the Soviet would do that is worth explaining very quickly. I mean, I think, as I mentioned earlier, the provisional government had the expertise and the experience to run the government, and the Soviet doesn't intend to take over that yet. So when Lenin comes back in April saying all power to the Soviets, even his own colleagues aren't particularly supportive. They think that this man's been in Switzerland. He's been out of the country for a decade plus. What does he really know about the situation? He's an impressive leader, but he's out of touch. And it is a battle for Lenin to convince his colleagues that actually a policy of all power to Soviets was more in line with ordinary workers' opinion than maintaining a confusing kind of coalition or kind of compromised situation with the provisional government, who are so obviously middle class. For many workers becoming increasingly radical, it seems important really that we should get rid of this provisional government. Now, in so doing, what Lenin is what he's doing here is he's actually breaking some rules of Marxist theory, which the Mensheviks are sticking more closely to. The Mensheviks said that what we should have is a period of development run by the middle classes, and then eventually the workers would take over. What Lenin is arguing here is to just shortcut that process and jump straight to a workers' revolution.
And Lenin isn't the only problem facing the provisional government that summer. Lucy, can you tell us some of the extraordinary buffeting that the provisional government has to face across that summer?
So some of their sort of buffeting that they face is internal. So the various parties that made up the provisional government disagreed particularly about how to deal with the peasant land issue. So since the revolution in February, where the Tsar has been, he's been forced to abdicate, many peasants had seized land. So the disagreement sort of centered around, the middle class sort of cadets and Octoberists saw this as theft. They thought the land should be returned to the landlords who owned it, whilst, the sort of left-wing Mensheviks and SRs saw this as acceptable. So this internal buffeting was one part of it. Later on in the summer, the provisional government have to deal, obviously, with the Kronstadt naval uprising, where soldiers from the base in Kronstadt, they take to the streets and they protest against the provisional government and are eventually joined by workers.
Lucy, can you tell us a little bit about the July days as well? I mean, that seems to be a chaotic and messy affair, doesn't it?
Yeah. So the July days was where there was this uprising. There was, strikers that had taken to the streets. That could have potentially been the moment for the Bolsheviks to seize power. But Lenin, at this point, he sort of falters. He isn't ready. He hasn't organized this uprising. And he doesn't take charge. He doesn't take the lead. And so, the uprising is put down. And, the Bolshevik moment almost seems to be lost.
We just heard from Lucy, the Bolshevik moment's lost. Lenin seems to bottle the opportunity he gets in July 1917. Ben, what damage does that do to the Bolsheviks, and how does he turn things around later in the autumn?
Well, in the short term, it is enormous damage to the Bolsheviks. Lenin himself has to go into hiding because he is associated with these July days, and the government now has revealed the details of his return to Russia. He's been painted as a German spy, someone who's been accepting money from the Germans, and of course during the war he's therefore working with the enemy. So the Bolshevik reputation is totally trashed by the provisional government, and very successfully. Leading Bolsheviks are arrested, including Trotsky, and even Lenin in hiding laments that essentially he feels he has messed up. This is one opportunity to secure the revolution in Russia, and it has failed. So certainly in the aftermath of the July days, the position of the Bolsheviks is a dismal one, frankly.
He now seems like yesterday's man. I mean, what enables him to turn things around?
Yeah, absolutely. There's two factors that play a role in the resurgence of the Bolsheviks. One is the war. The Prussian government has maintained Russia's involvement in the war. And this policy does not have the full-hearted support of ordinary workers and soldiers. During the revolution that got rid of the Tsar, many people in the streets were calling for an end to war. But for the Duma, they wanted to get rid of the Tsar so that they could fight the war better. And this split becomes wider during the summer. There's been a new offensive. The Russians have launched a new offensive. But for workers and soldiers, this is confusing. They felt that if they are going to continue the war, they needed to merely defend Russia's borders. To launch an actual offensive, smacked of imperialism, smacked of czarist policy. And so during the war, what we see is increasing desertions from the Russian army, and the Bolsheviks start to win over ordinary soldiers with their calls to end the war. So that's working kind of under the surface, I suppose, to gradually increase Bolshevik support amongst ordinary workers and soldiers. In addition, then, how does the situation for Lenin and Trotsky and what have you, how has that recovered? Tristan mentioned earlier the fears of a potential right-wing counter-revolutionary coup. And this exactly is what transpires in August of 1917. So Kornilov, a man we haven't mentioned yet, but he's appointed by Alexander Kerensky, who's now in charge of the provisional government, to be commander-in-chief. Now, Kornilov is on the far right of the political spectrum, and he has no... he has no love for the Soviets, certainly. And at the end of August, it's a very confusing affair, but he orders his soldiers from the front to march on Petrograd, and they have given orders to remove the Soviets. Kornilov says he believes, that Kerensky and the provisional government are now under the influence of the Soviets. In fact, they're almost being held hostage by the Soviets. So Kornilov orders his men to Petrograd to close down the Soviets and, at least on the face of it, save the provisional government. However, Kerensky is not too sure. Kerensky increasingly fears that actually what Kornilov intends to do is get rid of the Soviets and then also get rid of him and the provisional government and take over as some right-wing military dictator. Faced with the situation of soldiers being ordered by Kornilov marching on Petrograd, Kerensky is in a bit of a bind. He reaches to the Soviet for support. And the Soviet says, well, we will support you. Obviously, we have the loyalty of workers and soldiers, but we won't continue to do so. We won't try and help unless you release the Bolsheviks that you arrested after the July days from prison. So Trotsky is released. Many other Bolsheviks are released from prison. And having got that, the Soviet calls for soldiers of the garrison of Petrograd to defend Petrograd and for the workers to prevent in any way they can the arrival of these troops. Kerensky arms these Bolsheviks supporters and other kind of workers and soldiers in Petrograd, and it's very successful in the sense the Kornilov revolt does fail. The railway workers stop the trains taking the soldiers to Petrograd. Ordinary soldiers appeal to their comrades that actually to disobey the orders of Kornilov and to open their eyes to what Kornilov is trying to achieve.
And this is a big success for the Bolsheviks, isn't it? I think what we're going to do, we're going to move on just to look at the actual seizure of power, because the Bolsheviks' reputation is rehabilitated by their role in defeating Kornilov. And Lenin, after massive arguments within the party, succeeds in persuading the Bolshevik Central Committee to go ahead with a seizure of power. Tristan, could you tell us a little bit about the importance of Trotsky in making that decision into reality and actually going for the seizure of power?
Well, one of the great effects of the Kornilov affair was that as the Bolsheviks rose in popularity, Trotsky had become chairman of the Petrograd Soviet, and then had created a military wing of the Petrograd Soviet, which he was then leader of. Which meant that when the October Revolution started, he was in charge of the military forces within Petrograd. And in fact, it was his planning which meant that the October Revolution was so successful.
And this is basically an urban seizure of power, isn't it? We're talking about Petrograd and Moscow, aren't we?
Absolutely. And in fact, it was remarkably peaceful. Only I think six people died. When it was over, Lenin managed to take the tram to take over control in Petrograd. So this was not a huge battle in the streets.
Lucy, many of us have seen the film footage from Eisenstein's Red October of crowds, heavily armed crowds, sort of shooting their way into the Winter Palace. How does the Winter Palace fall? Is it really that big military operation?
It's not quite as it is portrayed there. So on the 25th of October, the Red Guards do indeed sort of surround the Winter Palace and eventually storm it, but they face almost no resistance once they do. The Cossack Guards who were at the palace surrendered immediately, and government ministers were arrested with relative ease. Kerensky did, however, manage to escape to France, so he wasn't arrested. But the day after the seizure of Winter Palace, Lenin announces that the provisional government no longer exists and that the Bolsheviks politics would be governing in conjunction with the Soviets.
This sounds like freedom at last for the workers. Is this really the free worker state that so many leftist intellectuals have wanted?
Well, initially, it probably did feel that way. Sovnarkom, so that's the new government set up by Lenin, does issue a whole series of decrees, essentially giving everyone in Russia almost what they wanted in a bid to try and get as much support as possible. So peasants were given the land, workers were given control of their factories, the eight-hour working day is established to prevent workers being exploited and forced to work longer. Elections for constituent assembly go on as planned. So it must have felt at the time, I suppose, that yes, the workers' state had arrived and things we're going to get better. However, Lenin is not interested in sharing power with other socialist parties. He is keen to maintain power with the Bolsheviks, and when faced with the reality that other parties are not happy with this, he has to create a one-party dictatorship. So the Constituent Assembly, elected in November and comes to sit in January, is closed down after one day. The Cheka, a replacement secret police, is set up in November, and it institutes a reign of terror, arresting political opponents and preventing proper political debate, just to defend the Bolsheviks' grip on power.
And a civil war breaks out, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. So the other parties initially don't really do much after the Bolsheviks seize power, because nobody really expects them to do to last very long. They're very much in the minority. They control Petrograd, they control Moscow. And the elections constituent assembly are just around the corner. Once Lenin has closed down the constituent assembly, however, it is clear to many Russians that this is a party that is not going to surrender power without a fight. So Tsarist supporters, the officers of the army, for instance, create a white army that they mobilize in the kind of middle of 1918 to fight for Russia and to overthrow the Bolsheviks. They're joined by democrat-loving Russians in a slightly uneasy coalition, which ultimately will collapse during the Civil War and hinder the white attempts to win. During the Civil War, the Bolsheviks find themselves opposed by a whole range of enemies and surrounded largely. They control Petrograd and Moscow in the centre of Russia, and that's largely it.
Interesting. Could you tell us about the international reaction, especially among Russia's former wartime allies?
Well, they were horrified. This was their worst nightmare. The Russians at one blow had completely wiped off one of the fronts of the First World War. Britain and the US especially were very keen to see the overthrow of the communist regime in Russia.
It seems an extraordinary coalition ranged against Lenin. I mean, how on earth did he win? It seems that everybody hates the Bolsheviks, is out to do them down.
Absolutely. You wouldn't have put any money at all on Lenin and the Bolsheviks lasting particularly long. They had major advantages, though, in that they controlled the two major cities within Russia. They were brilliantly organised. Their ideology was simple and highly attractive. They controlled the logistics. They controlled the larger part of the Russian economy, and they had the ace of foreign policy as well.
Lucy, could you tell us a little bit about the economic policies that the Bolsheviks used to strengthen their hold in this emergency situation?
So the Bolshevik early economic policies anyway were entirely focused on winning the civil war. So the Bolsheviks implemented something known as war communism. So the aim of this was to supply the Red Army. So war communism involved the nationalization of all industries. It banned private trade and crucially it introduced food rationing and grain requisitioning. So this allowed the Red Army to be well supplied. So in that sense, it achieved its aim. However, the effect of this policy was to really alienate large amounts of the peasants. So the peasants were the ones who bore the brunt of requisitioning. This sort of, generated a lot of hatred towards the Bolsheviks initially, and peasant riots took place, so that the largest of which was in the Tambov region, which required 50,000 Red Army soldiers to put down.
So Lenin had talked about bread, peace and land, but he didn't seem to bring much of any of these to the countryside, did he?
No, certainly not during the Civil War. That all aims, all promises had to become secondary to winning the Civil War initially.
And what about Germany? Because of course the Provisional Government had continued the war with Germany. Is Lenin able to fight a war, both the Civil War and a war with Germany?
No. So actually, how the war ends with Germany can be considered one of the causes of the Russian Civil War. So the Bolsheviks obviously had initially promised to end the war, and that is what they went out to achieve. So Lenin initially attempted to postpone the signing of any sort of peace treaty with the Germans, as he knew it would be an extremely harsh treaty. They were negotiating from a point of weakness. Eventually, in March 1918, however, Russia have to begin negotiations, and eventually the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk was signed on the 3rd of March. So this ends Russia's involvement in the First World War, but the territory was extremely harsh, as expected. Russia lose 25% of their population, 50% of the land which produced grain, coal and iron. So yeah, it was a very harsh settlement.
And the Bolsheviks clearly pay a huge price for winning that civil war, which is essentially won by the end of 1921. Surely now this is the time for full-scale communist economic policies to be brought in. Tristan, is that what happens?
No, not at all. The economy after the Civil War, and after, of course, fighting the First World War, is in ruins. It's very clear that grain requisitioning of war communism was not producing the grain that was required, and it was also causing vast levels of starvation and hunger. So in 1921, Lenin reveals his new economic policy at the 10th Party Congress. This is in March. And he allows small levels of capitalism again. So small businesses are allowed to operate. There was an end to grain requisitioning, which is replaced by a sort of a tax in kind, whereby the peasant surrenders a certain amount of the produce he makes, and it's equivalent to a fixed sum of money.
And who's Bukharin? Does he have a role in this?
This is all Bukharin's idea, it is not at all a particularly popular move. In fact, he causes a split within the Bolsheviks between left Bolsheviks and right Bolsheviks. This is considered a right Bolshevik move to move towards capitalism. And left Bolsheviks, which include Trotsky, were very, very, very much against the NEP. And the NEP does suffer from a large amount of opposition.
This must have had an incredible wear and tear on Lenin, having launched a revolution, a civil war, and then had to manage a party that seems to be bitterly divided. Ben, can you tell us about Lenin's state of health by the early 1920s?
Yes, well, by 1921, Lenin is physically exhausted. You've mentioned some of the battles he had to fight, and he's, in addition, he's not level-headed and calm. He's prone to rages, and this can't be great for his blood pressure. And his family also have a history of kind of strokes and heart attacks.
And someone tried to shoot him, didn't they?
And indeed, he was shot in 1918 and almost killed. And a bullet was lodged in his neck, and they only got out in 1922, the operation obviously didn't help him either particularly. He's done incredible things since 1917. He's fought political battles, convincing colleagues of the April Theses. He had to fight hard to convince colleagues that the October Revolution needed to be kind of undertaken. Brest-Litovsk, as mentioned, was very controversial and split the Bolsheviks as well. And, of course, the NEP. So he's been fighting these political battles throughout. He's been chairman of Sovnarkom, so he's been head of the government. He has run the war communism during the Civil War. And he was indeed lucky to survive this assassination attempt. By 1921, he's exhausted, and he's ill, listless. For the first time in his life, doesn't feel like working, which really alarms him.
And he has strokes, doesn't he?
And in 1922, he has a massive stroke, which he survives, but his right side was paralysed. While he is able to recover some of his ability to communicate, and is in a position to influence policy to a degree, it is quite clear he's on his last legs and will be moving into retirement, though that is cut short by another stroke, which will ultimately kill him.
In February 1917, none of the Tsar's family had wanted to follow Nicholas, and you can scarcely blame them. What about Lenin in 1922-3? Did anyone want to take on that role?
Well, in some ways it's difficult to say, because the culture of Bolshevism was hostile to personal ambition. Revolutions in the past have been replaced with kind of dictators like the French Revolution and Napoleon Bonaparte, and the English Revolution and Oliver Cromwell. So everyone's on the lookout for somebody who might try and take power for themselves rather than rule through collective leadership. Now, in 1923 and 1924, when Lenin ultimately dies, the most likely candidate for this kind of military dictator is Trotsky, thanks to his control of the Red Army. Trotsky is also personally odious to many of his colleagues. He's ambitious and rude, reads books during meetings to indicate his contempt. And so, actually, when Lenin dies, it's very much a stop Trotsky move rather than any one particular figure trying to take control. That's successful. But once Trotsky is sidelined, then the ambitions and rivalries become more apparent. And there's one figure who does stand out as clearly out for power for himself, and that is Stalin. Very much in the background, a bureaucrat, and nevertheless very in touch with the interests and the views of ordinary Bolsheviks, and also very happy to ditch ideology when it suits him. And ultimately that will explain why, even though he's perhaps the least charismatic of leaders, by the end of the decade, by 1929, he is clearly the paramount leader in the amongst the Bolsheviks, and his birthday is celebrated in a way which indicates that a cult of personality is being created around him.
In previous revolutions, we've seen how royal families were able to escape, whether in England in the 1650s or in France in the early 1790s. Lucy, can you tell us what happened to the Tsar's family and why there is no return?
So, essentially, there were these rumours, in the years after that, maybe some of the descendants of the Tsar had survived. So if you're to believe the Disney film Anastasia, then one of the Tsar's, one of the Tsar's daughters survived. She survived the assassinations in Ekaterinburg and becomes a lonely orphan in Russia. However, in reality, none of the royal family survived. So on July 17th, 1918, the entire royal family were killed by an execution squad in the basement of the house in which they were being kept in Ekaterinburg. So the rumours of survival come from the fact that when the bodies were discovered in 1991, two of the children's remains could not be found. So this sort of fueled the conspiracy. But the remains of the two missing children were eventually discovered in 2008.
And am I right in thinking that he and his family are now venerated by the Russian Orthodox Church as saints?
Yeah.
Ben Lewsley, Lucy Robb and Tristan McLeod, thank you very much for talking today about Russia 1913 to 1924.